I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guests today are Simon Bramwell and Ian Bray. Simon Bramwell is a co-founder of Extinction Rebellion, a climate activist group dedicated to the belief that real change will only come through mass civil disobedience. He's a bushcraft instructor who is looking after his terminally ill mother. Ian Bray is also an Extinction Rebellion co-founder and is a father of two, Quaker, and a salvage and repair worker. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you, Derek. Thanks for having us here.
Yeah, thank you.
Would you like to start by talking about Extinction Rebellion, or would you like to dive right into the Shell action, or would you like to start somewhere else?
Well, I mean, I suppose that's a bit of an open question as well. Thank you, Derek. I mean, myself and Ian have been discussing this today just around, in our regard, the importance of some beginnings. And just to recognize with our own story, like for a lot of people, this phenomena called Extinction Rebellion kind of launched itself into the world in this massive, colorful spectacle of what you might call resistance. And we've also been talking about its beginnings. Like before Extinction Rebellion, there was an organization that we were involved in and helped create called Rising Up, whose aim was to promote social change through civil resistance and nonviolent civil disobedience on behalf of environmental and ecological issues. More properly, Extinction Rebellion comes from Rising Up. Do you want anything to add to that, Eric?
I think we're also concerned with social justice.
Yeah, and also wrapped up in those social justice issues. Pottedly, obviously, there's a huge lineage in regards to nonviolent direct action, civil resistance and social change, of which we are only part of the process. And I think for myself, in regards to Rising Up and the trajectory into Extinction Rebellion, it was very much fundamentally, how do we not so much enter into an agreement with an ideology that was driving us, but how do we have a curiosity about how things change? And how do we also break certain barriers to participation? And so it was very much a curiosity and a kind of an experimental inquiry, albeit one that put us frequently on the front lines and at the eye of the police.
I think we were very keen to learn through sort of rapid iteration of campaigns. Try something, see how it works, and then try it again with a few changes. And we worked on a lot of campaigns like that.
Can we back up a moment? And when you say, you know, how social change occurs, or talking about using various tactics, various strategies, what is the point? What does Extinction Rebellion want? What are you complaining about? And I use complaining not as a negative sense.
Yeah.
Why the need for it in the first place?
Okay, do you want me to go for this, Ian? Thank you. I mean, again, this is, I think, only a question that I can answer from my own immediate desires and wants. But for myself, it was primarily around social justice and also how that interweaves primarily with what you might call nature of liberation, just the absolute need to campaign, to resist and to struggle for nature.
And before we started recording, You and I were just chatting a little bit about wildlife, and you talked about how you have been on other continents and what a gift it is to see wild creatures, and how this is much less common in Britain. So I guess what I'm trying to get at is, what's the relationship between biodiversity crash and the creation of Extinction Rebellion? Sorry to be so basic.
No need to apologize at all. Well, this has also been one of the sort of points of contention sometimes within Extinction Rebellion. When we first made the decision to move into sort of a make or break campaign, there were obviously a lot of discussions around that. There was a lot of people who wanted it to be called everything from like climate rebellion, and it was all based around that kind of very human-centered kind of carbon fundamentalism, if you will. And there was a a couple of voices, myself included, who were very clear that we needed to include the voice of the other than human, our biodiversity kin, as it were. And so that's where the primary energy behind, like, the extinction in Extinction Rebellion came from. The recognition that it's not just about bloody humans, and that species of animals and plants are going under every day, unremembered, unexperienced, and that it was also a way of weaving them in into this larger catastrophe that civilization has kind of like brought on the planet.
Thank you for that. So let's continue to move forward a little bit. Can you talk about some of the evolution of Extinction Rebellion and its tactics and the evolution of its goals as well, and how they led eventually to other things, including the offices of Shell?
So again, like, reaching back into where the sort of lineage of civil disobedience and non-violent civil disobedience comes from, obviously there's like such a huge array of diversity of tactics and campaigns to learn from. And we try to learn from them all in that regards. To begin with, like, Rising Up and Extinction Rebellion had quite a nebulous theory of change around just doing stuff like sitting in the streets, disrupting the sort of business as usual reality of most people on this planet at the moment, and trying to get them to sort of basically trying to, I suppose, in a way, interject with reality to try and get them, or get, sneak information into them, if you will, through sort of campaigning and messaging and all the rest of it. So we tried so many different types of civil disobedience that would be probably more recognizable in Britain than maybe elsewhere, and certainly like only really applicable to Britain. Things like locking on in the road with steel tubes, shutting down airports, as well as sort of more sort of liberal kind of disobedient acts like die-ins and things of that nature. And yet there's always been a recognition, and also part of, I suppose, our own experimental inquiry in a way, in around where do we take that? What else happens? Obviously, Extinction Rebellion is very public facing, and we're a non-violent organization, but there's always been the realization that if you would, criminal damage, as it's called here in Britain, or more widely like property damage, might also have to be part of the diversity of tactics. Again, in the same way that we kind of put it in the early days, it's like, in case of emergency, break glass. Sometimes it takes the sound of breaking glass for people to sit up and notice. And this is still obviously a very contentious issue, but we're a few years in right now. And so that's also a constantly evolving conversation that doesn't have just one answer. It's obviously sort of perspective-based. There's still people who argue that we shouldn't be smashing windows or causing criminal damage. And yet, as the catastrophe unfolds, there's bigger questions around how we remove social licenses from destructive corporations, how we remain also, or try to remain as potentially, and I don't mean to be quite so vain, but as the sort of conscious, or rather conscience, of sections of humanity as well. So yeah, it's been a constantly evolving thing that we've tried to keep on top of, and also been willing in many ways to do. How do you feel about swearing, Derek? Because I can swear quite a bit here and there.
I think we're not supposed to swear too much, because this is not just a podcast, but also goes over the air on radio.
Right, marvelous. Okay, in that case, I should try and mitigate some of my language there. But yeah, we're prepared to mess things up, to balls things up, to get things wrong. And I think that's been one of the things that drew us together in both Rising Up and Extinction Rebellion, was this willingness to experiment and get it wrong, which can be quite a major no-no in the sort of environmental, largely kind of left ideology kind of field in a way. And I think that's stood us in good stead. It's caused a lot of controversy, obviously, with protesters as well, like Ian doing actions like getting up on top of trains, for example, and stopping public transport in that way. But again, it's all being this massive experimental inquiry.
I don't really understand how anybody. Well, I'll just speak for myself. The only way I learn is by making mistakes.
And, yeah, well, exactly. Yeah,
and yeah, I'll try something, and God, that was a really stupid thing to do. So I'm not going to do it again. So can we back up for a second? I'm really liking everything you're saying, and one of the primary purposes of this whole series of interviews that I've been doing for 5 or 6 or 7 years now is to try to get people to get off their behinds and to defend what they love. And so can you talk about what it was in each of you, or what were the catalysts in each of you that took you from being people who said, wow, there sure is a lot of stuff going wrong, and then, you know, switch over and watch another TV station. That actually got you off your behinds to do things. How can you talk about that process, especially in terms of how someone else who, I don't know, loves a particular species of amphibian goes from just going, gosh, I love them, to doing something, or someone who loves long form thinking. Or loves independent bookstores. You know, I don't care what it is.
Ian. Oh, okay. Laura is aware that like my colleague Ian is probably one of the most deeply profound humans I know, and yet also doesn't silence is a way of life for him, which I deeply respect as well. Just to put that out there and recognize that I can also just ramble on too much. I think for myself, it's love that motivates me, Derek. It's like, for me, love is an act of will. We've become very used in our kind of transactional consumer society to think that like love is this kind of like fake temporary thing we almost interact with. Oh, I love this TV show, or oh, I love that dress in the window. And we've come to regard nature wholly as part of that kind of fake temporary love in a way. And for me, the deep, profound love of nature compelled me to act. As I said, I've spent most of my life in and out of nature as a bushcraft instructor, as a wanderer, as a vagabond, as all sorts. And it's just the growing realization of the sheer apocalyptic carnage that's happening to our natural world. And the deep grief that I was feeling about that, like, again, in my lifetime, we've had like 70% of wildlife in Britain die, be destroyed. And that was a major motivator for me. I couldn't any longer really teach kids about the love of nature and then look into their eyes and realize that they're going to grow up without knowing just how full the sky can be full of birdsong, or how rich the soil can be with beetles and worms and all the rest of it, and up to and including trees as well. So a bit of an epiphany for me in that respect. A waypoint in my journey was back in 2015 when I was involved in a tree occupation in Bristol, which was like the first iteration of Rising Up, where we were trying to protect some trees in Bristol. Part of this, we've got this thing in England called like blue finger soil, which is like the kind of oldest, most fertile soil we have in Britain. And there's only like 1.5% of it left in the country. And so we're in these trees, we're occupying them. It was all quite business as usual in regards to sort of activism and manarchism and all the rest of it. And eventually we lost, as we often do. And the trees came down and were destroyed. And it was this, for me, it's this process of finally giving into the grief as well. It was like, how the hell do we do things differently? How do we actually make a difference rather than these grand gestures of resistance that don't actually lead to any nature being liberated, being freed or recognized? And I'm trying not to use the word saved as well, because I'm fully aware that that term comes with a lot of baggage, as it were. But yeah, that's me. It's all about love. It's all about love from Fox to Stag Beetle to Starling and beyond.
Thank you for that. So let's move forward a little bit. Oh, I have another question before we start talking about Shell, which is when the group Buffalo Field Campaign first formed many years ago to help protect buffalo, Rosalie Little Thunder, one of the founders, said to some of the other people, I've heard from some of the people who were around at the beginning of it, said, you know, we're gonna spend, she said something to the effect of, we're gonna spend, you know, 15% of our effort is gonna go to protecting buffalo, and 85% is going to be intrahuman drama created by Yeah, you're laughing. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So can you comment for anybody who is young and excited and wants to join or start an organization? Can you comment on some of the difficulties you have faced and perhaps overcome that have nothing to do with, you know, Shell or the other side, but some of the difficulties that come just to normalize the acceptance that, look, if you get in an organization, there's going to be some troubles that don't come yep. from police repression, etc. Can you just talk about that for a minute? And you laugh, okay. So I presume this is something yeah. you're at least a little familiar with.
Oh no, absolutely. And I think it's something that every activist needs to recognize. That again, they will get involved in personal drama, ego will get in the way, trauma especially will get in the way, the patriarchy will get in the way, colonialism will get in the way. We bring immense amounts of baggage with us into activism. And again, it's not a term I particularly like. One of the only things I can really think of off the top of my head was, again, when we first set out on the venture with Rising Up, one of my primary ambitions was to get, like the anarchists I knew, out of lock-ons and get them onto meditation mats, and to get the bloody hippies off their meditation mats and into the lock-ons. So I think, again, part and parcel, and not onlys, is that when we embark on an endeavor like this, we've also got to do quite an amount of self-work to just recognize what we're bringing into these spaces of activism or social justice, of environmentalism, because we've all got it, all our fecal matter stinks in that regard. And it is a struggle. So I think it's like, do the work, be aware of yourself, be aware of how your culture views nature, the kind of Euclidean or Descartesian kind of mindsets that we bring in, this reductionism, this essentialism, the human exceptionalism. I mean, there's so many bloody isms around it. So yeah, just really, really be aware and take time to have grace for yourself and other people as well, especially when, again, we're meant to be doing this on behalf of nature. Of course, we're part of that nature. But yeah, it's like, if we can drop the drama, we'll get a lot more stuff done.
This is a little bit more of a digression, but I often think about what Lewis Mumford wrote about with the mega machine, which was what he thought, and I agree, is one of the most important inventions of this culture. And what a mega machine is a large top-down military style bureaucratic organization that allowed the Egyptians to create the pyramids. It's and his point is that it's, you know, humans are pretty contentious, and it's an absolutely extraordinary thing to be able to get a million people to work toward the same end, whether that end is being in an army invading another country or selling Coca-Cola or running a television station. And I'm not here valorizing that organizational schema. I marvel. I mean, for crying out loud, you know, getting together for a picnic or for a potluck where everybody's bringing food, that even leads to drama sometimes. So for gosh sakes, to have, you know, to get like 10,000 people or 100,000 people to actually pull in the same direction is something of an organizational.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Did you want to check with anything there, Ian?
I suspect it's also a spiritual feat.
Yes. Yeah.
Something we were always interested in at the outset was, you know, the non-rational insights into what we were doing. I think that approach is sort of rather limiting in and of itself, just to go down the scientific rationalism path. And it was a lot about, you know, looking into ourselves, and as Quakers would say, you know, seeing what love requires of us, and learning to put ourselves second, and it's, you know, escape the kind of consumer mindset that we're all swimming in.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, thank and you I, for that.
And I think there's something in there for me as well. Like, I actually really quite like dislike movements, and I think one of the broader ambitions of Extinction Rebellion, like not one of its more material demands or anything, was again, how do we create a sort of mass decentralized autonomous system where like each individual has a praxis of resistance beyond just waving flags around in the kind of protestable on the streets kind of thing. I mean, eventually I'd like to think that, again, hierarchies, although they can be, as you say, they can be incredibly productive, which I think is also part of our unhealthy human condition. If we could have like every activist who gets out on the streets also bringing that praxis back to their locality, like, and when they go out for walks, standing on badger tracks, or whatever it might mean, like nature liberation for them in that regard, if it is rewilding or an area or whatever. And I think that for me is where we then potentially can find the sort of redemptive opportunity to come back into balance with ourselves without that kind of transactional nature of mass movements or the need for ideologies, greater ideologies or movement identities, which also get pretty contentious and quickly can sort of stagnate in their, what I'd call like their egregoric function, start going, go a little bit haywire, as it were.
To put it another way, we kind of quite a punk aesthetic.
So yeah.
Just get out there and do it. Don't wait for sanction from the experts.
Absolutely.
You know, get out there and try it. Do what you can. You know, you don't need fancy instruments to play. And kind of learn that way.
You know, I'm loving everything you're saying. And this is, if you would like, at some point in the future, I think it would be really interesting to have a discussion about the relative merits of that sort of top-down organizing versus the what are the advantages and disadvantages of both that plus the autonomous actions. And part of what I'm thinking about, and I don't really want to go here right now because it would take time from, we still haven't gotten to Shell and I want to get there. But which is part of the delight of this whole conversation, by the way, for me, is I know that, for example, the Turkish nation had a policy of attacking in piecemeal for like 300 years from, let's say, I don't know, late 15th century to late 18th century. And they basically lost every battle because they would attack this unit by itself and this unit by itself, and their opponents, the Russians quite often, would attack as a cohesive unit.
Yeah.
And that, again, I don't really want to take us too far down this path today, but at some point, if you'd like, I would love to have a discussion about the advantages and the disadvantages of each of those organizational forms.
Yeah, would certainly love to discuss that because, again, for me, I mean, you talk about the Turks, what immediately came to my mind was the resistance that the British tribes put up against the Romans. And you had this kind of piecemeal, individualistic, heroic method of warfare that unfortunately didn't survive against the sort of might of Roman steel in formation under a very strict hierarchy. And yet, I think, again, there's models for every time. I don't particularly have anything against hierarchies on the whole, but I'd hope that one day, especially in regards to where we are now, that and again today kind of proved the point in the beautiful chaos and emergence on the streets that you can have autonomy, that as long as you've got that sort of tactical awareness, you can murmurate together. And it, I think it's again becoming literate with those kind of dynamics, which again, it has its pros and cons. It has its pros and cons.
Well, exactly. And I think I love that you just said literate in that, because if we just, and you also were earlier talking about, you know, not sort of letting ideologies run it. So if your ideology is we can never have any hierarchy, well, let's discuss that, you know, no gods, no masters. Let's discuss no gods, no masters. Let's discuss everything. Let's put everything on the table and figure out what we're going to do. Anyway, let's, sorry to take us so far afield, but
no worries.
But let's move on to Shell. So A, what's wrong with Shell? B, what did you do? C, why did you do it? And D, what happened? And E, why was that important?
Yeah. We can work our way down the alphabet there, Derek.
I can remember the list.
Yeah. Did you want to talk to any of that here?
No, you start.
Okay. What's wrong with Shell? What's bloody right with Shell? Again, it's one of the most destructive oil majors that are promoting fossil fuels and plastic everything, mechanized everything. There's personal reasons in it for us, for L4, for why Shell. Some of us, for example, were drawn to giving voice to the people in the Niger Delta, the Ogoni people who have suffered greatly under Shell. And obviously the environment there has suffered abysmally under Shell, where soils there are so saturated with poisons, they're like dead to a depth of 9 foot in places. Mm. And this is just one of the oil majors. And I'm just feeling just...
I just want to mention quickly that I believe, I could be wrong, but I believe that the Niger Delta was the largest and most biologically diverse delta in Africa. I could be wrong on that, but it was an extraordinary place before it began being killed.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, it's been murdered, it's been destroyed. An entire bioregion has ultimately become extinct. Hearing, I think that's a little owl in the background. Beautiful. Yeah, so there are many reasons why we chose Shell. Partly, again, Shell, like a lot of the oil majors, has known for over 40 years about climate change. Their own scientists verified and concluded that climate change was driven by industrialized human activity. And then, of course, they, along with groups like ExxonMobil, spent absolute tens of millions in funding misinformation and climate denial. So it was quite an obvious target in some way. And there's a little bit more depth for it for me as well. I was lucky enough to know a woman called Polly Higgins, who was what they call the earth lawyer, who was trying to introduce ecocide into kind of international legislation. And at the time, she was dying of cancer. So we also kind of partly did the action on her behalf to kind of bring Shell to task, as it were, in a way, also trying to sneak magically, in the broader sense of terms like ecocide in there. So that's partly why we did it. I think there was also something for me as well in regards to, whilst the sort of April 29 rebellion was taking off, most people were... had the aim of sitting in the streets and disrupting the sort of business as usual of a city's arteries. And there's a recognition of me that actually might have to take the fight, or we needed to take the fight, as you were, the struggle, whichever terminology you want to use, to the mega corporations. and that there was also a need for a certain amount of dissonance in regards to tactics, something to wake people up, as well as also to experiment, the sort of curiosity of what would happen if we went and did so much damage to the Shell building that we ended up in front of a Crown Court here in Britain. So all that was in the mix. Am I missing anything out there, Ian, that you can immediately bring to mind?
I think for me, one of the reasons I did it was me, a PhD student from Gunnerland.
Right, yeah.
Who actually did a workshop and showed us pictures of kids around a water tap, drinking the water, of course. And Shell had very kindly put a sign on it saying, you know, do not drink this water, it's contaminated with benzene, you know, to cover their own asses. But they hadn't provided an alternative water supply. So it's just really a straightforward human level. I don't think it needs a lot of science and a massive amount of background.
No.
It's just to see, you know, straightforward crimes committed like that and hear it firsthand from someone who's actually been there.
I think one of the other things, the major things that sort of went into the mix as well, was intention-wise, trying to not necessarily be in opposition to the state in a way, but more also trying to inculcate an attitude of humility and grace whilst we did it. I mean, I know it sort of butts up against some of your own writings around things like sort of covert direct action against the state and against like Leviathan, if you will. And we came in from a slightly different angle, I suppose, in a way, for us, certainly from a little bit more of a sort of spiritual angle than perhaps many environmental activists would have had. Yeah, and again, just with this just sort of inquiry of what would happen ultimately.
And I think there was also, you know, around wanting to be in front of a jury where actually, you know, normal kind of working class people off the street in the UK have actually got power to make a decision that can have some effect. We previously spent lots of time doing minor criminal damage, which basically involved chalk spraying on windows. So we were talking about window cleaning, bills to fix it. And the magistrates always said, there's not a sufficiently close nexus between the damage you've done and the crime or the harm you think you're stopping. So we were very keen to, you know, move up a level where we get, you know, real people off the street and see what they thought. And that obviously involves taking the risk of the higher sentencing penalties of a higher court.
Yeah, thanks, Ian. And Ian, do you reckon trying to bring in what we were talking about the idea of like improper property in a way?
Well, improper property is this idea from, I think, you know, from the peace movement about, it was originally, I think, created around the idea of, you know, hammering on warheads and stuff, that these things shouldn't exist for any means. Therefore, it's legitimate to try and kind of remove them from existence, or at least symbolically. The Shell building obviously is at one remove from that. We weren't attacking the pipelines or anything like Jessica Resnick was. But it's something we could do in the UK. It was within our reach and it was also within our budget.
Yeah.
It was a very cheap action to do, you know, cost £300 or £400, I think.
And again, that thing of also just also to bring into question the social license. Uh-huh. Of these organisations as well. Does that go some way to answering part of your questions there, Derek?
Yeah, this is great. This is perfect. So how many of there were you and who were on the front lines of that one? I'm not talking about support, but you can talk about that if you want. And what happened?
Okay, so there were 7 of us who were in the top of that direct front line. 3 of us, myself and 2 of my co-defendants, colleagues, went and basically with automated center punches, went and smashed the front doors of the Shell building. And obviously the word smash is quite a forceful word. That's why we use sort of center punches. We didn't want to use hammers or anything like that. So we smashed the front windows causing X amount of damage, and then basically sat amongst the broken glass and waited for the police to arrive. Meanwhile, Ian and another colleague of ours took a target of opportunity and scaled this massive height via a scaffold onto this giant, I think it was like 30, 40 meter high awning.
No, about 10 meters, I think.
Okay.
High enough.
Yeah. So, and there they were there for like nearly 24 hours or so, wasn't it?
Yeah, just under a day.
And again, we're spray painting the building there. And then another couple of colleagues were also spray painting on the walls of the shell building on the ground floor. So again, it was just this recognition that it was quite a spectacle. And we were using slogans like Shell Kills, Shell New, things of that nature.
CO2 crime scene, I think.
CO2 crime scene.
And for Polly.
Yeah. That was quite an important one, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I think with two of us going up on the canopy, that gave the action some kind of durability. Because the crew doing the distraction and the windows downstairs were mopped up by the police fairly quickly. The two of us stayed up there for a day. And as we'd already taken five sites that morning in London, it then opened up a kind of sixth front, if you like, for the police to deal with, which they hadn't been expecting. We kind of advertised the locations of the five sites they were going to take for camps. So we were kind of the optics, if you like. You know, made some good photos in the press.
And I think it got people thinking, both rebels and public alike. I mean, again, Derek, it was kind of like the first, apart from the location, like the site takes and occupations, it was like the first big action of the rebellion. And whilst like the rest of the rebellion was very colourful, very like immensely beautiful and also mischievous and disobedient, ours was a little bit more of a, I suppose, a little bit more of his punky kind of cry. Really?
I just wanted to mention that, you know, I've been doing these interviews for 6 or 7 years, and once a week, a different person every week. And I interviewed Polly Higgins a few years ago, and I just want to mention that was one of my favorite interviews I've ever done, one of my top 10, I think.
I miss the woman. I had the fortune to live in the same town as her, knew her very well. And yeah, extraordinary bloody soul, extraordinary soul. And her public persona as well, hid the absolute heart of a trickster in, just wonderful, wonderful soul.
Okay, so what happened next? You, the cops show up.
Yeah, they did. And they said to us on the canopy, we're actually not going to get a cherry picker and get you down.
You're up there for good.
So in the end, we kind of negotiated to come down and did a press conference, a short piece of press off the media, off the scaffolding. And then we kind of negotiate to be arrested without handcuffs. I kind of always find that's important, that we, you know, treat the arresting officers with respect. And we were, you know, arrested and processed. And so we were kind of a day later than everybody else.
Yeah, and we were arrested and removed relatively quickly. So I think within the sort of hour and a half, really, the action, we were in police vans and on our way to the cells for a while. And I think it's worthy just to note that when you had come down, there's another person, Fahana Yamin, who is, again, an environmental lawyer. She helped pen the Paris agreement, but she also superglued herself to the Shell building for a very short while, but wasn't charged by the police. I didn't think they wanted to charge such a high profile person. And she basically said, yeah, it's time for direct action because like I've helped create the Paris agreements and they're worthless ultimately. It's time for direct action.
So you go, do we want to skip to where you go to court, or is there anything that happens in between you want to talk about?
Well, there was a very long delay, partly, you know, we wondered if Shell would actually provide evidence. You know, not all of these companies do want to be put into court, and they took about 4 months to provide a statement. And then the prosecution, for us to be told the prosecution would proceed. And then we were slated for July 2020, and then we were held in limbo, you know, for the best part of another year because of COVID. So there's all those completely unforeseen variables. And in the meantime, you know, we were on bail conditions and
still taking action here and there
and whatnot. Yeah, so that kind of made everything else more complicated because you've always got this stuff on your slate and it's unresolved.
Yeah, and the kind of sword of the state poised over your head, as it were, Derek.
Yeah.
I think it probably is important to talk about the court trial briefly, don't you?
Yeah.
I mean, again, like our intention, I mean, like, so for example, the British legal system decided not to allow us a legal defence, essentially, Derek. You have a sort of series of excuses that have been, or defences, as it were, that have been established under the law, things like necessity, trying to prevent a greater crime, things of that nature. And these were all denied us by the judge, ultimately. And so we couldn't argue like lawyers. We all self-represented in the end. And we talked about our motivations and what had taken us to this point, what had motivated us to take action. And again, I think intention was very important in there. We weren't trying to be clever. We weren't trying to oppose the law, as it were. We offered ourselves up to the law in a way. And do you want to speak a little bit about that sort of fidelity to the law?
Yeah, well, we had a policy of, well, Simon and I certainly, of what you call radical honesty. We volunteered more than we, you know, needed or had to. We decided we weren't going to try and, you know, game the trial in any way. We would tell the jury everything about us.
Just to interject, that included a whole load of previous actions.
Yeah, and previous convictions for criminal damage to government buildings, which was voluntary on our part. And we thought it was better that the jury knew that what we were doing is part of a longer term strategy and not some kind of, you know, random act of outrage. This was kind of well considered. And we were doing it for good reason, and we basically abandoned any pretense at legal defence. You know, we didn't try going in as amateurs against the professionals. So I said this to the judge and the jury that essentially the UK lacks a court of morality, and a court of law is the nearest thing we've got where real people are empowered to make a decision, either the jury, that could have some further reaching effect. So we concentrated basically purely on that. And I think it was partly the absurdity of this trial. You know, I think they thought once that we were told we had no defense in law, the rational thing to do would be to flip to a guilty plea and get one third off the sentence, you know, because there's basically, we were, you know, 99.9% certain to be going down for this offence.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, the kind of like absurdity of that position, and even the judge at the end, when he was directing the jury, said this is a very unusual trial.
And again, I mean, again, one of the things we brought up, which we couldn't obviously submit as evidence, was just the fact that, again, our laws are utterly incapable of really, truly judging the situation that we face on this planet at the moment, that humanity through its industrial activity is destroying biodiversity, destroying humanity's chances of survival, and again is incapable really of representing nature in any kind of way beyond just reducing it to a resource. So we managed to get quite a lot in there, as well as, again, like our personal experience of what took us to this point.
Yeah, and we also had some just mentioned a minute about fidelity to the law, and this is a kind of concept I'm retrospectively applying. I've only learned about since, but it's essentially what we were doing. Martin Luther King talked about fidelity to the law. So it's about not only do we allow ourselves to be fully accountable for the action, i.e. we allow the police to arrest us, we don't try and escape, you know, we weren't wearing masks or anything, but also we fully submit to the processes of the court and accept that if we're going to be cut short by the judge, that's what has to happen. You know, we fully submit to the process. And it's by, you know, kind of putting our necks on the block, I think,
that helped the jury to make the decision that they did.
Yeah, because and that's just one thing that we also did, I suppose. I felt very, very grateful for the jury for being heard by them by taking up their time. We also offered our thanks for the jury's courage, for their ability, or potentially their ability, to go beyond what the rules of our society demanded of them, in a way.
And we were kind of also keen to apologise to the jury. You know, we've been on quite long journeys into this. I think some of the jury was like quite new stuff to them.
And I mean, we talk about sort of just the depth of how fucked we all are in regards to the ecological apocalypse, and again, just the depths of grief that can cause into relationship with.
So can you, I don't think you've actually said explicitly, unless I missed it, what did the jury say? So, I mean, we have this wonderful slash horrible buildup where you are presenting, you're acknowledging you did it. The judge is saying you have no defense. Then the jury goes out. And then what happens?
Well, the first thing the jury did was come back to the judge to ask about, you know, for a copy of the oath that they had sworn. Because they were obviously taking this obligation quite seriously. So they actually asked for a copy of the oath so they could kind of look and balance the evidence against the oath they'd sworn.
And to continue from there?
Yeah, and essentially we had no dialogue with the jury, no two-way dialogue. You know, the only words we effectively hear from the jury are the verdict at the end.
Yeah.
They can't ask us questions or for clarification or anything else in the ecosystem.
Mm.
And what we could say to them in court was very strictly managed. I think most of the court time was with the jury out of the room and the judge sort of instructing us what we could and couldn't say.
Yeah. But regardless of all that, again, regardless of the directions of the judge, the jury came out, and with some of them visibly moved and in tears, found us not guilty.
I know this is a kind of terrible thing to say, but that's like a great movie.
I don't know. I mean, good Lord, maybe we have to discuss who the cast is there, Derek. It sounds like a great movie, and over here in the sort of UK environmental sort of activist scene, it was hailed as quite a significant victory. I personally didn't feel any sense of victory. Obviously, because it's not stopping any trees from coming down. It's not stopping any birds' nests from being destroyed or bat roosts from being turfed out and animals dispossessed.
Not stopping any carbon going into the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And also, it was a dignified process, and we were, you know, key not to... I didn't feel jubilant at the end of it.
No.
Like I say, it's exhausting, and we were asked a lot, you know, why weren't we smiling in the pictures? And what did we think it meant? But we're too close in time and proximity for any, you know, decent perspective on this. And obviously, subsequently, you know, there's been a few more XR jury trials, all of which have resulted in acquittals. Interestingly, the one we had before, the jury, when they returned the verdict, actually said with reluctance, because they were much more carefully guided by the judge to find the defendants guilty.
Mm.
And that jury looked visibly bent out of shape. And every time he gave the verdict for each offence, the foreman said with reluctance, and they kept telling him not to. And he did it every time for every charge, as a kind of small mini protest.
Yeah.
That jury didn't, you know, kind of felt that sort of morally coerced.
Mm.
Well, we were lucky, you know, with our jury that they felt they could, you know, view the you know, build the their consciences and their morality as well as the black letter of the law.
The black letter of the law, aye.
Into their decision.
Aye.
And this is a principle that's been established in British law for sort of 300 odd years now, on the back of a Quaker trial, as it happens.
You know, we're rapidly running out of time. And I mean that for the interview, not only for the planet. And
which comes first?
I cannot tell you how much I understand what you're saying about the lack of joy, because it didn't stop any trees from being cut, etc. And you know, I've written all these books on environmental stuff, and one of my most favorite lines is, every morning when I wake up, I ask myself whether I should write or blow up a dam. And the point of that is symbolic versus non-symbolic action. Uh-huh. And so I completely agree with what you're saying. And I also want to say to you that we're fighting a larger war or struggle or whatever word you want to use. And symbolic victories do have their place, I believe.
Most definitely.
And so while it didn't save any trees, and even when you do save trees, there's the famous David Brower line, every environmental victory is temporary and every loss is permanent.
Yeah.
And I fully understand all that. But I also, from the outside, just want to say thank you and to say that you did accomplish something. You didn't save any trees, but you did accomplish something.
Thank you, Derek.
So in our last like minute or two, I have absolutely no idea how you should wind up. So I'm going to leave that up to you. You have a minute or two to, I don't know what to do. So what do you want to do for the last minute?
I would just ask everybody out there who's listening to this and in any way feels any resonance, rage or grief, just to get out there. Whether you do it once a day and you go and you release an animal from a trap, or you go and sab a JCB or a pipeline or found a local environmental group, just get out there, just do it. Find the love, find the grief, just do it.
Yeah, I think not focusing on outcomes is very important. It's more about discerning that the action itself in the first place is rightly guided.
Aye. Amen.
And to move on from there, we were quite prepared, if necessary, and quite more or less expecting actually to go on to sentencing and possibly a short jail term. Part it was a little bit of an anticlimax, wasn't it? In some ways,
yeah,
because we were kind of expecting maybe another year in this process. You know, we didn't think we'd get to the finish so quickly.
No,
so it was kind of an anticlimax in some ways.
Yeah,
but yeah, it's about discerning carefully. You know, what you need to be doing. And that's not always what you find comfortable or rewarding.
No, not at all.
Certainly on your own terms.
And again, we have been shanghaied. We've been sold snake oil in regards to how our societies present themselves around the length or quantity of life rather than the depth. And the only way we're going to really, really reach into those depths is by stepping out of those comfort zones, by getting into the grit, by getting into the marrow, trying.
Doing what love requires of us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for that. And thank you for your work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guests today have been Simon Bramwell and Ian Bray. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.